and it's just about time for the bike show today, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. They have a guest in the studio and one on the phone. It's going to be a nice, light show. Please enjoy what's coming up on KBOO Portland. And let's hear a couple of announcements before that.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on his birthday, Monday, January 8th. Come ride your bike around Portland with Diablo as we celebrate the life and music of David Bowie with a mobile dance party and sing-along. Again, that's the second annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride at 7 p.m. at the Bowie Bike Lane at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Main on January 8th in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage on the community events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Rocker T and the 7th Street Band on Saturday, January 6th, beginning at 9 p.m. at Mississippi Studios in Portland. Rocker T is from Brooklyn and has 7 albums released by a number of labels playing reggae and reggaeton. Also performing will be local artist Aaron Nigel Smith, Heavy City, and DJ Kansaman. Again, that's Rocker T and the 7th Street Band on Saturday, January 6th, 9 p.m. at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Always helping each other along the road.
Gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes 2 pedals, 2 wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars.
Good morning and a happy new year. Welcome to the KBOO Bike Show, coming to you from Portland, Oregon, the first Wednesday of each month on 90.7 FM, streaming live on kboo.com and also archived. Our engineer today is Tammy Dean. Good morning and a happy new year to you, Tammy. My name is Alon Robb, and I'm joined in the studio by Terry Campbell. Good morning, Terry.
Morning, Alon.
How are you today? Any New Year resolutions to be kept or broken?
Already, probably.
Anything beyond, you know, working for world peace and justice and all those other good causes?
Nothing special. My wife and I put together a little goals chart at the beginning of the year, and we have to have that finished. The first deadline is this Sunday, so we need to figure that out. World peace will definitely be on that goals chart, and if the two of us can figure that out, that would be quite the year, I think.
And in a year, we'll check how many of those goals were met.
Fair enough.
In the first half of the show, we will be joined in the studio by Evan Schneider, writer and editor of a beautiful and rich and content literary journal titled Bone Shaker. In the second half of the hour, we will speak via the phone with Bill Nesper, executive director of the League of American Cyclists. Before we introduce Evan and Boneshaker magazine, a few news items from across the wide universe of cycling. In December, former Portland Mayor Vera Katz died. During her 3 terms from 1993 to 2005, public transportation and cycling were promoted. As an Oregon state representative in 1979, she described the legislature's vote to embark gas tax revenue solely for maintenance and expansion of highways as a triumph of concrete over the needs of humanity. During her tenure, the East Bank Esplanade with its bicycle and pedestrian paths was created. May she rest in peace. Also in our town, a Burnside Bridge maintenance project will start on January 5th. The $20 million upgrade and repair will take 2 years and will close about half of all car lanes, but biking and walking access will be kept, though more limited and shared with pedestrians, except for a few detours through Waterfront Park, which will last for several months. In southern Germany, construction of a bicycle autobahn that connects 10 cities and covers 62 miles is about to start. The goal is to make cycling safer and remove 50,000 vehicles from the highways. The 13-foot-wide bikeways and parallel pedestrian paths are separated from car lanes. Tunnels, lights, and snow clearing will also be included. As many studies of the elderly and sick have shown, daily outings improve physical and mental health. Copenhagen cyclist Ola Kassau, during his daily rides by a nursing home, noticed a 97-year-old man sitting outside and waving at him. Ola wondered if he and other residents might be interested in biking. He rented a cargo tricycle that has a passenger compartment in front of the cyclist and started offering rides. The riders returned invigorated, talkative, more willing to spend less time in bed and more time outside. This led to the creation of the nonprofit Cycling Without Age. There are now 250 chapters in 29 cities, with 8,000 elderly cycling regularly. And speaking of the elderly in years but young at heart, the world's oldest cyclist, Robert Marchand of France, is still going strong at 106. 5 feet tall and weighing 100 pounds, the former firefighter, prisoner of war, lumberjack, gardener, and wine dealer recently set a world record in a one-hour track cycling in the over 100 age group, riding 26 kilometers or 16 miles in that hour. After setting his record, he declared, "I could have done better if I had seen the 10-minute warning card. Otherwise, I would have pedaled slightly faster." He attributes his fitness and longevity to a diet consisting of lots of fruits, vegetables, a little meat, not too much wine, and an hour a day on the cycling home trainer. The night before setting his record, he drank a glass of wine. He is also a member of the French Communist Party, and for the past 90 years has been a union member, trade union member, participating in many strikes. All right, so we'll move on to the first part of the show, where we will speak with our first guest, Evan Schneider. And since the earliest days of cycling, artists and writers have sang the praises of this modest vehicle. They have done so in poems and novels, musical compositions, art and films. A list of the creators who fell under the bicycle spells includes H.G. Wells, Samuel Beckett, Nikki Giovanni, Charlie Chaplin, Sylvia Plath, Patti Smith, Lou Shan, Leo Tolstoy, Arthur Conan Doyle, and many, many more, and many of these writing about their love of cycling. Bone Shaker magazine is part of this rich tradition while carving its own path. In its own words, it fashions itself to be the practical bicyclist literary periodical style handbook. Good morning, Evan, and welcome to our show.
Good morning. Thank you both for having me.
Before we start with the magazine and hear more about it, I'd like to know a little bit about yourself, your background, interests.
Sure. Well, I am a writer and editor by trade, and I've been at it for close to 20 years now. I studied English literature at Colorado State University, and then I went on to get my master's degree from the University of Rhode Island in English literature as well. I specialized in what one could say is a very useful part of English literature in 18th century autobiography. So you can imagine how many job offers I got out of graduate school, which led indirectly to me starting Bone Shaker, a bicycling almanac, in that at the time I was very excited to be reading and writing, and I had had a very long, I guess, love of bicycling since my dad taught me to ride back when I was a child. And I looked around at the periodicals that were offered about bicycling, and I only saw glossy, ad-filled magazines. I saw these magazines weren't even filled with necessarily bicycling advertisements, but rather advertisements for cars, which really befuddled me. So I thought, where is the artistic literary journal about bicycling? And I looked and I looked and I didn't see it anywhere, which I realized then meant it was I who would need to start it. So I put out a call for submissions. I was essentially asking for artistic representations of the bicycle commute. And when I was first explaining to people what the magazine would be, no one could really understand it. But once the first issue came out, it really took off, and it resonated with people that seemed to have this experience on a bike every day that they wanted to write about. And I said somewhere along the line that bicycling seemed to lend itself to infinitude. And I still think that, in that you could write over and over and over about that journey because it's so so beautiful and so artistic.
What was the journey to Boneshaker? From my reading of cycling history, was the name for an early style of bike, and I can only assume what they were trying to express by the name Boneshaker. But could you maybe give us a little bit of insight into what that term means to you, and how you came about it, and how that became the name of your publication?
Yeah, sure. I think my knowledge of bicycle history is from David V. Herlihy's really impressive tome called Bicycle: A History, unless it's Bicycle: The History, which it would be an important distinction. But in there, he outlines this trajectory of bicycle development throughout the late 1800s, and the Boneshaker being one of the prototypical bicycles that was two giant iron wheels connected by a piece of wood, which lend itself, I believe, to that name Boneshaker, in that when you rode it, your bones shook with every roll of the axle. And, you know, when I was reading that book, you get about three quarters of the way through before they even discover the chain, the idea of not having a direct drive mechanism, which gives rise to your high wheel and your ordinary, but rather this idea of, oh, we can power the back wheel if we only had a method to do so. Mm-hmm. But I really liked that moment before that was sort of discovered, and it kind of lent, I thought, to this idea of getting out there and having a very raw experience in the saddle with yourself, alone, oftentimes with nature. So I liked that throwback to the beginning of the bicycle journey as a mechanism, a machine.
And sometimes when I ride on Portland roads, it does feel like I'm still experiencing that in my old bones. That book you mentioned, by the way, Bicycle: The History, is a wonderful book with lots of illustrations, but unfortunately it out of 400 pages, it only has a page about China and India. It is definitely focused on the West, but it is a wonderful and well-written book. The journal is comprised of interviews, profiles of grassroots organizations and of individuals, essays, lists, letters, charts, maps, poems, manifestos, art, stories, and I probably left out a few things. Who are some of the writers and readers? How do people submit?
Well, since the beginning, we fashioned Boneshaker to be a submission-based periodical. And so we're open always to any bike-related writing or art. And we did that first call for submissions. And then once the first issue came out, it's just been submissions rolling in since then, people all over the world. As an editor, I tried never in any one issue to focus on one particular geographical area, especially those that are so well known for cycling, like Minneapolis or Portland or San Francisco. Though those are certainly represented in the journal, I was really excited about people writing in from Atlanta, Georgia, or Toronto, or South Africa, or Leeds, England, and their experience using the bicycle to get where they're going. Seemed to, no matter where people were riding, seemed to empower them to have some sort of, I guess, decision about how they get where they're going, and have very positive repercussions because of that personal journey.
And the readers, do you have a sense of who they are, or where they come from?
Yeah, the readers, they, as you might expect, they traditionally love, they love bicycling. They're often touring bicyclists. Usually each issue has a long kind of a long form piece, kind of like a ride journal. Somebody rode from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon, for example. Or so writers are big readers, as are writers. I did fashion it from my literary experience after a literary journal. And so it's writers and writers really trying to capture that experience of being in the saddle.
And do the submitters, are there specific themes that you're looking for? I mean, you've mentioned sort of commuting and touring. Are there, for different different issues, you have a theme for that issue? Or is there, how do you craft, how do you start deciphering the different submissions and figuring out which ones are going to be worthy of publishing?
Well, that's a great question.
Yeah, in other words, how do you avoid making many enemies with those rejection notes?
Yeah, it's an interesting experience, having been the writer for so long and then now being the editor and having to make those hard decisions about what would make it into what I was considering the narrative arc for each issue. And the narrative arc was never based around a theme other than bicycling, and I worried at the outset that I may not get enough varied content. Would people write poems? Would people write an essay? Would people do artwork? And they never disappointed me. So I always had a very wide range of things to choose from, be it a sonnet, be it a hand-drawn map of a commute, be it an interview with Lee Rinaldo of Sonic Youth, who rides his bicycle every day. So I was never at an impasse or a lack of quality material to publish. It then became, ooh, I already have a really nice ride journal in this issue, so I may have to push that for next one. Or this one's already, this issue maybe is a little too poetry heavy or nonfiction heavy. So I just tried to take the submissions that I got and cull from them and put together an issue that I thought, if you read from cover to cover, you would get an experience that seemed crafted in such a way where the juxtaposition of pieces could be read to influence each other. But also, if you picked it up and just read one standalone piece, you would be as inspired or as impressed with the inclusion.
That's great.
You are listening to the KBO Bike Show on 90.7 FM and through live streaming at kbo.com. And the show is also archived. And today we're speaking in the studio with Evan Schneider of Boneshaker Magazine, a wonderful publication about bicycles and bicycle life. Evan, can you read a few selections?
I can. I think maybe in the spirit of the fact that we just had the first full moon and super moon of 2018, which will be bookended this month with a blue moon, because it'll be the second full moon in January, I believe on the 30th or the 31st, I would read for you the full moon ride schedule, which was adapted from our last issue, BA43500, which was issue 10. This moon, the one you've set a reminder to see, is a moon made for riding. Baskets strewn with tine twied apple cake and strong whiskey in a metal flask. This moon is for long underwear and an extra pair of socks, flannel shirts and worn out scarves waving from behind us as we pop together over gravel roads. This moon is for picking the perfect spot on someone else's land as we watch it rise over the cracked oak tree whose branches have been empty for a while now. This is a moon for dodging potholes, a hoot and a holler, as we race home red-cheeked and fingers tingling, eyes blurry from the wind. This moon is for passing round your last bottle of homebrew and hunching over chili bowls and warm bread next to a small ringed fire in the withered yard. This moon is for resting our heads against the backs of our chairs and opening our eyes wide in the crisp winter air and wondering about the stars and black holes and where exactly we're supposed to go from here. This is a moon for dark hour whispers around a wooden table as you sip coffee in your kitchen that smells heavily of herbs, the sun threatening to come up again off in the east somewhere. It's a moon your weary legs can use to climb familiar stairs without switching on the light and crawl into bed next to someone warm, moon rays creeping across the floor.
Lovely. Wow. That's very inspiring. I think I'll be looking for that blue moon at the end of the month here. So how frequently does the publication come out? Is it a quarterly, or does it as enough quality content hits your laptop and is soothed into position? How?
That is a rather unfortunate question, because I had set out, I believe, in the early days to do maybe 2 issues a year, but here we are 10 issues later, and I had only ever made 10 issues. And that was sometimes 2 in 1 year, sometimes 1 every 2 years. It got complicated with full-time jobs and buying a home and doing everything that one needs to do to succeed in this world today. But yeah, it seemed to be about 1 every year. And in 2018, which is now the 10th anniversary of the start of the publication, we're putting out this fall a best of Boneshaker book, which will be a compendium of all the best pieces that have come out since 2008 when we first started.
Great. And so Boneshaker sounds like it's not your full-time job, is more of a part-time job, volunteer.
It's make no mistake, it's a full-time job. It's just not one that pays a full-time salary.
Fair enough. Yeah, okay.
Labor of love, as they say.
I did not mean to depreciate your effort.
No,
for
you
sure.
Did not. Right. Yeah. Boneshaker has a very loyal following, but it's just a small thing that mm-hmm. sells for a modest amount, because we wanted everybody who was interested to be able to get a copy of the almanac. So back when we first started in 2008, it was $5 and now it's up to $8 a copy.
Got it.
And no funding from any car manufacturer or earth polluting company?
Correct. The closest that we got to any sort of sponsorship once was a one-time gift from a New Belgium Brewing Company, who we love and are good friends back in Fort Collins, mm-hmm. Colorado, who are employee-owned and bike advocates extraordinaire.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'm ready for another piece, if you could read.
I can. Mm-hmm. This one's called From This Day Forth, and it's from our third issue, which also went by BA42300. Please note, it doesn't stop, nor will it ever. Really, there will always be wind coming from both directions. There will always be hills and flat tires and forgotten locks and snapped spokes and sore legs and honking cars and wrong turns. There will be no one to ride with when you need them most. There will be frigidity when you forget your gloves. There will be heat when you bring your jacket. But all this makes no difference, because this is it. This is the world in which we live, and there really are no excuses except for those that we make in order to justify something we will later wish we hadn't justified. This is simply what we have to contend with. This is what we have to learn to overcome, that's all. It's a broken home where truth is difficult to discern and where time continually shoves us on from behind. And yet, there are cracks in the sidewalk from which hardy plants grow. There are roads that are smooth and flat and long. There are new moments and choices. There are hidden places to which we can retreat and regroup and regain our composure. So let us go there, even for just an afternoon, and enjoy wine from our water bottles and ask those questions we promised we wouldn't ask because they have no answers. Let us be that which we want to be. Let us look up and see not the sky falling, but us rising up to meet it. Let us, from this day forth, be bicyclists.
Thank you. That is beautiful. Our time is just vanishing quickly here, but wanted to ask you about a novel you wrote, A Simpler Machine Like the Lever, whose hero is, quote here, trying to get his life on track while holding his head high. Is that your autobiography, or what is the book about, and where does the bicycle fit into that?
I wrote A Simple Machine Like the Lever in 2009 and 2010, and it came out in 2011 from a publisher here in Portland, Oregon, Propeller Books. And having worked on Boneshaker Almanac for a few years, and having had my mind so thoroughly entrenched in bicycling and writing, I thought I would attempt to put together a novel where the protagonist or anti-hero needed to commute every day by bike and make ends meet with little more than the bicycle. And so he has some financial hardship and some relationship hardship, but all the while he trusts his bike implicitly, and it gets him where he wants to go, though I won't ruin it for you if that's where you want him to go in the end.
And is it going to be made into a movie for TV or not yet?
There was a moment where I had been able to sell the film rights and worked on a script with a pair of directors, but as most movies I think tend to go, this one did not get quite made, but that doesn't mean it can't be made someday.
Just not the right time.
Maybe
it's
not.
It's coming on. It's coming on. So what do you like to do on a bike in your own time as a cyclist? Do you commute? Do you like to go bike touring? Any other activities that inspire you to get out and go ride?
I love being outdoors in general, which is probably why I'm so enamored with bicycling. But just I am now lucky enough to work from home, so I don't bike commute to work anymore. But that doesn't mean that I don't get out on the bicycle to do errands and get around town. And I love my late 1970s Dawes Galaxy conversion that I turned into a flip-flop hub single-speed commuter with a basket. And just love the feeling of getting out and really just spinning wherever it is that I'm headed.
Great.
And you also have a project with your wife, Judith, called Hive of Industry.
That is what we called it in a moment of madness. But she and I, we've grown really interested in trying to grow our own food and become a little bit more self-sustaining. And I think it really is derived out of that same interest that I had in riding the bicycle, which is getting yourself somewhere under your own power. So we together as a team took that idea and took that ideology and made a giant garden in our small Portland yard. I think we have a total of 30 raised garden beds. And we also were lucky enough to find a piece of property out in Tillamook County that has a lot of trees and a lot of cleanup that it needs. A lot of TLC, but hopefully in the next 5, 10, 20 years we can enjoy more of that on a grander scale, growing some more food out in the forest.
Nice.
Well, thank you, Evan. Our time is up. You're listening to the KBO Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, on 90.7 FM and on the web at kbo.com. Thank you, Evan Schneider, writer and editor of Boneshaker magazine, for being on the show, and much success with your future projects. In the second half of the show, we will talk with Bill Nesper, executive director of the League of American Cyclists.
Mini Flores de Corrientes, un verdadero duende, un mago del bandoneón. Hábil y musical, siempre inspirado, lo va dejando para el ruso Beitelman. Gustavo Beitelman, auténtico gaucho judío de Venado Tuerlo, un sabio, quizás el músico argentino más importante residente en Europa. Va dejando la pelota para Lee Cruz, la violinista danesa tanguera, dinamita en los dedos y en el alma, bellísima. Va tocando la pelota por el costado para Cristo Müller. Cristo Müller se acerca al área, la va dejando para Filippo El Solal. Filippo El toca para Eduardo Macaró. Está frente al arquero, va a tirar Diogo.
Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on the web on kbo.com. In the studio are Terry Campbell and Alon Robb. In the first half of the show, we spoke with writer and editor Evan Schneider about his wonderful publication, Bone Shaker. In the second half of the show, we are happy to have as our guest Bill Nesper, Executive Director of the League of American Cyclists, an organization that has been founded in 1880. Known at first as the League of American Wheelmen, its membership exceeded 100,000 in 1898. So it's quite an amazing history. Good day, Bill, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you're in Washington, D.C., I believe?
Yeah, I'm in Washington, D.C.
Okay, I would say give our regards to the president, but maybe we'll pass on that this morning. Before we get to the organization and its history and many wonderful projects, can you tell us a little bit about your own background, your personal cycling history, and how you got involved with bicycle activism?
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot for having me and taking the time with me today. As you said, we're in Washington, D.C., and my own personal journey to the league started like a lot of people, with my first bike and really it being my primary instrument for freedom when I was a kid. I grew up in a smaller town in Florida, and, I really used the bike to get around, to be with friends and to do almost, all of the things that I got to do on my own, were really thanks to the access that was created by the bike. And I became an advocate, more of a bicycling advocate in college. So I went to the University of Florida, and there was a great community that was trying to make Gainesville, Florida more bike friendly. And really more than me, being involved in the bike advocacy side, it was this sort of eye-opening experience in college that, you really didn't need a car. I didn't want to spend the extra money to have a car, and so biking and walking was a great way for me to get around and do the things I wanted to do. And there's a great advocacy community in Gainesville. It's has the highest bicycle mode share in the South, and we are one of the highest in the South, and got a lot of good things done, and still to this day, it's a great place to ride. And then I moved to Washington, D.C., and started graduate school, and lo and behold, there was an awesome job opening at the League of American Bicyclists. This is 15 years ago. The plan was to become a high school history teacher, I heard about this great job, and I started working in the league as a membership assistant. So I was going to graduate school, and I got to talk to people about bicycling and make the case for being a league member, and really help this organization grow, I think, over the time that I've been here. So I've been here a long time. I finished up graduate school and stayed. Thankfully, I've had bosses that gave me opportunities to grow here. So I, for most of the time here at the league, I worked on the bicycle friendly community program and bicycle friendly business and university programs, where we give out awards for communities and businesses and universities and states for being bike friendly. So I, for most of my time here at the league, I've been working on that, and I got the great opportunity earlier this year to come on as interim executive director, and now officially since October as executive director.
Well, congratulations on that promotion. Sounds like a natural after being there for 15 years.
yeah.
And this is Terry. Thanks for joining us, Bill. For our listeners out here, could you give us a little bit of background on your organization and some sort of history? It has a long history, and maybe just a broad stroke on the programs you guys focus on.
Sure, absolutely. So the league, as you said, has been around since 1880. We were founded originally as a movement of bicyclists in the 1880s to get paved roads. We did have over 100,000 members around the turn of the century. For most of the 20th century, the league was the national organization of cyclists, but we mostly focusing on recreational gatherings, bicycling education. We developed an education program that's now called the Smart Cycling Program, towards the end of the 20th century, with 70s, 80s, and 90s, we added more bicycling advocacy. So we moved to Washington, D.C. So we're working at the federal level to get more investment in bicycling infrastructure and safety improvements, making sure that there are the federal policies in place to make sure bicyclists' rights are protected and that there are places to ride and that it's safe for everyone who wants to ride. We also work at the state and local level, as I said, on the Bicycle Friendly America certification program. So through those programs, the Bicycle Friendly Business, the Bicycle Friendly University, the Bicycle Friendly Communities programs, and the Bicycle Friendly States program, we provide a roadmap of actions stretching across what we call the five E's, those being engineering, education, encouragement, enforcement, and evaluation. So we have applications that communities and business universities can fill out and receive recognition and customized feedback from us to make improvements. And we give out awards from bronze through diamond. So Portland is currently a platinum level bicycle friendly community. And there are a good number of, there's seven other bicycle-friendly communities in Oregon and many bicycle-friendly businesses, universities as well. We also have, I mentioned the States program, it's a little bit different. It's not opt-in like the other programs. We gather information. We ask the state DOTs to provide information to us, and we gather information and put together a ranking of the states. And we just put that out, and that's a little bit different than the other certification programs. I mentioned the Smart Cycling Education Program, so we have 5,500.
Hold on just for a second, if you will, Bill. I want to ask you a few more questions about the bicycle friendly awards and program.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
So, what are some of the unexpected communities where positive change has occurred or that are doing well? Looking at the list, it seemed like a lot of the platinum, gold, and silver awards are mostly given to college towns or, cities in politically progressive states. Are there any silver winners or gold or
diamonds in the rough? So
yeah, in more conservative states. And also, I noticed that if I'm not mistaken, no diamond status has been achieved yet. What would it take to win that? Is it would a city have to be like a city in maybe Utrecht in the Netherlands or Freiburg in Germany?
I'll start maybe with that last one. Mm-hmm. So with the Bicycle Friendly Community Program, well, with all the programs, we're trying to create a large menu of actions that any place, it meets any place where it is to help them find some kind of success, you know, so that they can do something. You know, everybody needs a win. That doesn't mean we give out bronze awards to everybody. In fact, you know, only about 40% of those that apply get anything at all. But the program is designed that on the to receive a bronze award, it's more based on inputs, like the things that you're doing. So having some bicycling infrastructure in place, having a bike plan, having some education programs. When we start looking at there are no diamonds, and we'll talk about that in a second. As you move from silver to gold and beyond, we start looking more at outcomes. Not just the policy and programs that you're doing, but we're looking at the results of those things. So, namely, ridership and safety. You're right. The platinum level communities, not a lot of surprises there. You know, Boulder and Portland and, you know, Fort Collins. I think some of those communities would say, hey, we're not just phoning it in, or, you know, it's not so easy for us. And I think that that's true. We a few years back decided that we wanted to set a higher bar, maybe not the Utrecht, or the Freiburg bar, but, you know, set the bar a little bit higher. And it was platinum communities, including Portland, that was part of the conversation to say, hey, you know, set up the program is really useful in helping us benchmark and move towards a goal. Set a higher goal for us. Set something that's, you know, not, you know, unobtainium, but set something that is really high. So with that diamond level, we have required ridership and safety goals. So it's much more about outcomes, not only outcomes on ridership and safety, but also there's a survey component that a town would have to do to measure the outcomes of how people feel. And that's exactly what Copenhagen has done since the mid-90s with their bicycle account. You know, they're not only measuring, how great the network is or how many people are riding, but they're also asking people how they feel when they're riding. They ask questions like, how comfortable are you when you're riding side by side with a friend? You know, things like that. So that's the kind of thing that's in that diamond level. And yeah, nobody's there yet. We're trying to push them on to do that with the program. To your first part about, you know, are there any surprising silvers or golds? There are 430 bicycle-friendly communities now, and so in 50 states, so places like, I don't know, that might skew, I don't know how to measure that exactly, but maybe regionally, you know, we have places, like I said, Gainesville, Florida, St. Petersburg, Florida, that are, you know, at higher levels. You have places like Colorado Springs, that's at the silver level. Appleton, Wisconsin, that's at the silver level. Anchorage, Alaska, that's at the silver level. St. Louis, Missouri, you know, these are, you know, not college towns, these are really big cities. Indianapolis, Indiana, you know, we have a lot of communities that are not just big cities, progressive cities, college towns that are part of it. But of course, all those communities are, you know, a lot of those communities are.
Do you find that going through the community, going through the process of the five E's and laying all the findings out on the table, that they learn something about themselves and where sort of the roadblocks are for improving ridership? Is that kind of part of your process, sort of?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're not an enormous organization. Of course, we have 900 state and local advocacy organizations and bike clubs that around the country to, you know, help drive this process. But the process, you know, like all things, is incremental, and it's done at the local level. And so this application, I'm glad you brought it up, this application itself, just going through the process and looking at things and going, oh, yeah, well, maybe we should bring in the health department to be part of this conversation. And, oh, maybe we should bring over, Sarah from the school board, you know, like bringing people together for, you know, it's a, the application itself, I think, is a platform for collaboration. That's really what we've seen, and that's really the strength of the program, I think, is that, of course, we give out awards, and that drives, you know, some mayors, some councils, some business owner, you know, to do this. You know, of course, they want recognition for what they're doing, but I think the most powerful thing about the program is that process of coming together and saying, oh, hey, we should get recognition for these things that we're doing. You know, how is that thing going with that connection to, you know, the hospital? Or, you know, let's put that in here. And, like, what about the university? Oh, maybe they should, you know what, maybe they should be a bicycle friendly university too. It's just, it's a way to get recognition, but also to bring together a diverse set of people to learn about what's already happening in their town and also what they can do. And a lot of these things are kind of surprising, you know. I just want to say at one point about bringing people together, I think that's a really great way to get to the equity issue. I mean, to really, if you want to make a really inclusive bicycle-friendly community, it can't just be one part of the city, you know, and it has to be more than just one neighborhood, more than just one set of people doing this. Of course, you know, there are, you know, the bike clubs are really invested, the cycling instructors are very invested, the bike shops are very invested, but there are, the only way you're going to have a really successful, comprehensive bicycle-friendly community is by reaching every community and bringing them to the table and making sure that they're part of the assessment and then the plan to move forward.
Yeah, that sounds like a very integrated approach. And we heard from another guest at a show in September, about a similar effort in Mexico where a bunch of different industries and disciplines and community groups get together to sort of help improve bicycle access and rideability there. Do you have an international program where you're at the executive director level, you're connected in with other community-based organizations around the world? Europe's been mentioned, but I think there's plenty to learn from other folks in other parts of the world as well as ours.
Absolutely. You know, I don't want to say that there's a very strong I don't have a very strong network of colleagues doing the same kind of work that I guess I'm doing, that I've connected with, and that's something that I want to change. You know, we hear a lot from, our regional neighbors most of the time, you know, more than the rest of the world. But, you know, we're hearing from other groups in Central America, South America, of course, as I said, North America, and Europe. But yeah, there could be more collaboration. That's definitely an area for growth, without a doubt.
You're listening to the KBO Bike Show, and we're speaking with Bill Nesper, Executive Director of the League of American Bicyclists. And I noticed the League is involved in a lot of wonderful programs, the Bike It program, certification of instructors, the Women Bike program, which is especially important, you know, considering the League's early history, where only white men were members. It's seems really important. I'd like to ask you, though, about lobbying, because the League has been involved, it's been at the forefront of lobbying Congress. I'm wondering if you could talk about that. What are some of the things you're lobbying for and against, the challenges? How does it work? Do you have to give congressmen envelopes stuffed with dollars, or do you just transfer the funds to a bank in the Bahamas? So, you know, what are you working on, and how is that process?
Yeah, definitely no envelopes or bank transfers.
No suitcases with dollars.
Yeah. No suitcases with dollars. No. You know, we're it has to be said that, you know, we're funded. 80% of our funding is coming from individuals writing checks, and usually those checks are like $30, $40 a year. So the League has always been a movement of individual cyclists and groups, advocacy organizations. We recently have taken on a lot of the work of our sister organization, the Alliance for Biking and Walking, which has now dissolved. You know, there are groups in every city, or in every state, and in many cities around the country that are, you know, trying to get this work done at the local level, and have relied on, you know, the League to be at the federal level for years, and so we're on the Hill. We have a full-time government relations person, a lobbyist that is on the Hill and is representing people who ride bikes across the country. And she's up there every day, and that's less the kind of things you see in movies, and it's more the meeting with congressional offices and finding solutions to move forward on various bills. In our case, to improve the funding for better bicycling infrastructure and programming. There's a transportation bill that is done every 5 or so years, and so we're making sure that bicyclists are that the voices of cyclists are a part of that. We're up there making sure that when we're in Washington to make sure that when policies are being put in place, for instance, with the Federal Highway Administration, USDOT, when they were putting together performance measures for funding projects. We wanted to make sure that cyclist safety was part of that, and so we go out and engage our network of action takers, people that are part of the league or support the league, to provide comments on those performance measures, and so we're both working on the side where we're trying to increase funding and also making sure that the funding is being spent properly. And one of the platforms of our, or one of the planks of our platform, is local control. And it's something that we fought for and got, in the 2012, transportation bill, where, more money than ever before is going to, the Metropolitan Planning Organization, to the community itself. So, we feel that the innovation really is happening at that level, and that approach has the potential to be, more democratic. When people are closer to it, they're able to make better decisions, what are good for their community. And so there are, really cool stories out there of, how local control equals improvements, like in places like Indianapolis, like with their cultural trail, is a good example. There are examples like in Indiana and in Mississippi. They're both have examples of two states where local control has really helped bike ped project at the local level get done. And if the local governments didn't have the control, they wouldn't have been done. Similarly, in Oklahoma City, that's another surprising place that's not maybe on the usual list of communities that you think of when you're thinking of platinum level or high level bicycle friendly communities. But Oklahoma City, the downtown developments, including bicycle and pedestrian developments, were done thanks to having this local control. So it's something that's part of why we're here in D.C. We want to make sure that investment is there. And it's recently, I think, I don't know if you saw this, where the bicycle commuter benefit was under attack, and in fact it was taken out of the mm-hmm. last tax, this new tax plan. So someone wanted to go after this bicycle commuter benefit, which equals $5 million a year. So in that new tax plan, this was taken out, whereas instead of the $7.3 billion per year that are used for tax-free commuter car parking benefits. Hmm. So it definitely wasn't about saving money, but those are the kinds of things we're trying to make sure don't happen.
Does the league offer something similar to the League of Conservation Voters in a report card on congresspeople and senators at all, back to your members in various states to sort of see, so that I could see how my representatives have voted on bike legislation or bike-related transportation? Is that something that you guys have offered in the past? No, or?
We have not. We have not offered that. That's taking some notes. That's a neat idea.
Cool. I'll give you my email.
Yeah.
And I noticed, looking at the list of congresspeople who are members of the bicycle lobby, You know, some more to be expected, like Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer, who's been, you know, one of the best advocates for bicycles and riders since first elected. And then there are people like Republican Rob Portman of Ohio, who's an avid cyclist and yet votes always, you know, against any government regulation of gas, greenhouse gas emissions, votes for the Keystone Pipeline, oil drilling on public land, against the affordable health care. Why is he supporting cycling? It's kind of a mystery to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we try to, I think it's great to bring up, you know, Congressman Blumenauer as such a great leader in this movement. And, you know, having his voice and having his leadership here is definitely helpful. You know, we have a Congressional Bike Caucus that is bipartisan, and we really want to be bipartisan, or, you know, our bike partisan, and, you know, find ways to work across the aisle, specifically on, you know, bicycling solutions. So, you know, some of these congresspeople might not agree on the other things that you mentioned, but, you know, find the place where we can work together to make bicycling safe, to make bicycling more accessible for more people, for not just for environmental reasons, but for health reasons and for, you know, cost savings reasons and for, you know, it's just, you know, it's a fun thing to do. And, it's, you know, and it equals great quality of life, you know, and those sorts of reasons. And so, yeah, I think finding that, you know, one of the things we really believe in is finding that place where we can work together.
And as my late father used to say, if you need the thief, you cut the rope from the noose. I don't know where the time disappeared. It was great talking to you. We have just about 2 minutes, so wanted to ask you about the future. The League has been doing wonderful work since 1880. Looking into your crystal ball, what do you see happening, let's say, in 10 years from now and maybe in 100 years from now?
In a minute or less, Bill. Sorry. Elevator speech.
In 100 years. No, yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I think, you know, for us, we have to keep plugging away at what has been working and not overreach. And I think, as an organization, you know, we're excited about technological improvements that are going to make bicycling safer. We're excited about local control, you know, being able to reduce speed limits, a more network approach to building bicycle-friendly places. I'm really inspired. I think, you know, in 10 years, you know, you're going to see many, many more communities, not just, you know, urban centers, but also more suburban land-use areas that are going to have better bicycling and safer and better places for people to get around by bike. I think that we'll keep pushing to make sure that the cyclists are part of the conversation up here and that people on bikes are part of the conversation up here.
And Great. We're already inviting you to be on our show in 100 years. So.
Exactly.
If I keep riding, it might happen, right?
That's exactly right. Well, thanks again for the time today, Bill.
All right. Thanks so much.
Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show with our guest Evan Schneider, writer and editor of Boneshaker, and with Bill Nesper, executive director of the League of American Cyclists. Thank you and your fellow cyclists and activists for your good work and helping us move forwards to a more sustainable world. My name is Terry Campbell, and I would like to thank my co-host Alon Robb and our engineer Tammy Dean. All the best in the new year. May it be a better time for the planet and for her living creatures. A safe and enjoyable journey to all. We will see you next month. May your journeys be full of light.
It takes two pedals, two wheels, and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle, let's get together to pedal and roam. You can take a ride up
can ride on a trail, you can ride in the street, you can ride through a puddle, you can ride in the rain, you can take it on a bus, you can take it on a train, take a ride to the waterfront or down from the zoo. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the river in Portland. This year, Nelson Senior Vice President of U.S. Strategic Community Alliances and Consumer Engagement, Cheryl Grace, will be the keynote speaker. Grace has been with Nelson for 13 years, and for the past 7 years has overseen the production of a report on Black consumers, and will speak about the power of the Black dollar. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the river, 909 North Hayden Island Drive in Portland.